Welcome to A Republican Professor. I'm your host and my own host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Today is Sunday, 31 May, 2026 years after Jesus, and we're in the backyard again. As you can hear, we're next to the waterfall, the pool waterfall, and the sun is going down. And tomorrow's my Sabbath, as I work at the church as a church administrator, church warden, corporate officer, staff, and trying to keep these kids from burning the place down. And it's a difficult work, but the work continues. And the Lord is with me. The Lord is with that work. And I love it. I love it. Now, we're in Marxism, philosophy, and economics. And I'm going to remove the background noise so you can hear me. By Thomas Sowell, we're discussing this book. I've had this book since I was a wee lad in high school. I believe I got it at Barnes & Noble near the lake, Bowles and Wadsworth. If you know the Littleton area, the little town Littleton area, it's just down the street from Clement Park, just down the street from Columbine Library in Littleton, my hometown. I bought it at the Barnes & Noble with my paper route money. Yeah, this was published by Quill, Madison Avenue, New York, New York. I'm sure they're embarrassed that they published it now, but good job, Quill. It is 1985, Thomas Sowell. And Thomas Sowell, I remember reading his column in the newspaper because I delivered the newspaper and I actually read it from cover to cover. And I think it was every Tuesday or something that Thomas Sowell had a little piece in there. And I noticed that he is so-called black. That's what people would say, he's black, but that he was basically a Republican. Praise God. Now, I don't say that Thomas Sowell would call himself a Republican. I think he would call himself just a free-thinking American, maybe a libertarian or something like that. I don't know, but he's basically a Republican. If you look at his positions, that's what he is. Thomas Sowell is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University. He's been a professor of economics at leading American colleges and universities and has lectured in Singapore, Israel, Switzerland, and Chamonix, yeah, as well as across the United States. Now, there's a barcode there in case you wanted to, you know, take a picture of that with your phone or something. I'm not really sure what that does. Maybe it does something. I don't know. It was originally $8.95. I did pay full price for it. I've had this on my bookshelf throughout my Navy career, throughout my seminary career, throughout my career as a teacher, as a professor, for 20 years on the left-wing campuses. And I thought I would just share with you some of the stuff that I learned while I was in high school. And you know, and through my PhD in public law and American politics, this has only been verified. Now, this would be classified as political philosophy and economics, I suppose. I'm going to say basic political philosophy. And we're going to skip the preface. We might get to it later. Here's the table of contents. Economics and philosophy is what we're going to cover today. It's a chapter one. We're going to do a fair use of this and make a transformative reading of it. We'd like to thank Thomas Sowell for writing it. Thank you, Tom. And we'd like to thank Quill Press for making it available. Thank you. Go get your copy today. If you can find this version, good luck. But go get your copy today. Get a physical hard copy. Have it on your bookshelf. Impress your friends and scare your enemies. And pray for your enemies as well. The original thing in the New Testament was scare your enemies, and then they they added to it, pray for them. I'm just kidding. Pray for your enemies. Economics and Philosophy, Chapter 1. Let's get started. Let's discuss this. Philosophy and economics were not simply separate interests of Karl Marx. So starts Thomas Sowell in Marxism, Philosophy, and Economics. Let's get a little background noise. What do you say? You're in for a treat, guys. Original sound is on. Oh, thank you, Lord, for this waterfall. Thank you. Yeah, philosophy and economics were not simply separate interests of Karl Marx. His philosophy provided the intellectual framework and the very language in which Marx discussed economics. That language must be understood in order to understand Marxian economics, regardless of whether or not the economic substance is logically independent. Go ahead and just do noise removal here and continue on. The philosophy is also important in itself as the driving force behind a vision that has come to dominate a major part of the globe and of the human species. Amen, Tom. Remember, he's right. He's publishing this in the 80s, right? The Soviet Union, Communist China, Cuba, North Korea, the Iron Curtain, Eastern Europe, so on and so forth. Okay, Germany had two halves at this time. Berlin was divided among co along communist Marxist lines. Okay, so he says the philosophy is also important in itself as the driving force behind a vision that has come to dominate. Did you hear that? Has come to dominate a major part of the globe and of the human species. In Christianity, we're taught to love our neighbor. It's a command. And who's your neighbor? It's a person just sitting next to you. It's a person in need that you encounter along the way. Now, you're talking about major parts of the globe that are dominated and oppressing with left-wing crap, this crap. Humans created in the image of God. See Danka. Danka came on the podcast. She grew up under communism. Danka, thank you for coming on the podcast. She's also on our prayer team, by the way. Our prayer team got a really special video last night, our quarterly video asking for prayer. And boy, did they come through! They came through today. Thank you, prayer team. Marxian philosophy and economics derive from many sources, Tom continues, as well as bearing the unique imprint of Karl Marx and his lifelong friend and collaborator, Friedrich Engels. The towering figure of G.W.F. Hegel stands out among the philosophers influencing Marx's thought, but other elements of his philosophy go as far back as Democritus, Epicurus, and Lucretius. In ancient times, Helvidius and Holbach in the 18th century, and Feuerbach among the contemporaries of the young Marx. In economics, the analysis and terminology of David Ricardo provide much of the background for Marx's Capital, but the intellectual predecessor of both men was Adam Smith, patron saint of laissez-faire capitalism. A sharp distinction must be made between saying that the form of Marxian thought was shaped by some predecessor and saying that the substance was similar. Very good. Very good. This guy is good. This guy is good. The difference may be illustrated by comparing Hegel's description of a certain period of history with Marx's description, which was quite similar in form, but utterly different in content. First, Hegel, quote, "These three events, the so-called revival of learning, the flourishing of the fine arts, and the discovery of America, and the passage to India by the Cape, may be compared with that blush of dawn, which, after long storms, first betokens the return of a bright and glorious day." What a great selection, Tom. Let me look at the footnote here. Yahada, Yahada. It's not a footnote, it's an endnote, which is why it's taking so long. Oh boy. Okay, where's that from? Where's it from? It's from the Philosophy of History. Shocks. Sibri's translation, which is the translation I have, Dover. That's the translation I bought. I bought that at Barnes and Noble too. I didn't read it until I took a PhD course in the philosophy of history at Claremont Colleges during my PhD with Charles Kessler, who came on the podcast. Yeah, so my philosophy, I have three philosophy degrees, essentially, a master's in philosophy from Biola, focusing on religious epistemology there. Then a degree in bioethics from Loyola Marymount University, and I worked there for a while. I had two offices at Loyola, one in the philosophy department and one in the Bioethics Institute. And then I did a master's degree in political philosophy at the Claremont Colleges. I did political philosophy in American politics for the master's in politics. And then I did a PhD in public law in American politics. So I switched out of philosophy for the doctorate to do public law because I felt like I already had a lot of philosophy and I didn't. I taught philosophy for 15 years at the college level, places like Loyola Marymount and Pepperdine and the community colleges, Cal State, Northridge, and Biola, Cal Lutheran. I taught in the government department and history department at Azusa Pacific University. I taught in the criminal justice department and I taught constitutional law for the politics and criminal justice department at Cal State Fullerton. And I taught in the business department at Cal State Northridge as well, and the business department at Pepperdine. I had to get hired by three different chairs. Sorry, two different chairs at Pepperdine. The business chair had to hire me for a business ethics and public policy. Connie James had to interview me when she was the chair. And then Mary Mullins hired me for the HEUT, Humanities Teacher Education Division, which included philosophy at the time, back in the day at Pepperdine. Now, check it out. Check it before you wreck it. So what I'm saying is, I've studied philosophy. I've studied Marx. I had to read Marx at Claremont Colleges in my graduate school. And so I'm telling you, this is legit. He was a Marxist at Harvard when he was a student, and he later abandoned it and thought, man, I was just a foolish young kid. It's all on YouTube. You can check it out. It's in his books. Okay, so this is Hegel saying, this is great. This stuff is great. This is advancement. This is progress. Then Marx describes the same stuff. The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signalized the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. What's similar between Marx and Hegel? Hegel says these three events, the so-called revival of learning, the flourishing of fine arts, and the discovery of America, and the passage to India by the Cape, may be compared to that blush of dawn, which, after long storms, first betokens the return of a bright and glorious day. See, that's positive. He thinks this is progress. Progressives love Hegel in terms of the form. Marx considers himself a progressive as well. He's using the same form, but the substance is different. That's what Soule is saying. So he's saying Marx was quite open and frank in declaring himself the pupil of that mighty thinker, Hegel, and deliberately used the modes of expression peculiar to him in writing Capital. But he also sharply distinguished the method of presentation from the substantive inquiry, page 12 at the bottom. To say that Hegelianism was the language in which Marx expressed many concepts is not to say that Marx's substantive statements repeat Hegel. Very good. Very good. It does say, however, that understanding the peculiar language and intellectual framework of a Hegel or a Ricardo is necessary for understanding the economics of Marx. This is wonderful. Are you enjoying this? Let's listen to the waterfall a little bit. I'm going to light up. I know you're wondering, what am I smoking? Well, I got a little cigar here. It's a Toasty Jones Skinny Maduro. It's one of my faves. I'm not going to tell you how much I paid for it because you will think it's crappy. This is 250 buck Chuck here. I got it for 250 a stick. That's $250. Just kidding. 250 cents. Got it super cheap on Cigar Page. Cigarpage.com. And I just got, a bunch of them, like 40 or whatever. It lasts me a while because I think I got these last summer. So 250, not bad. And then I got just blue collar Woodford here. It's great. It's fine. Woodford, the cheapest Woodford Reserve I could get. It's great. It's just the cheapest kind, but it's the one that doesn't affect me. None of the Woodford, I'm Woodford gets really expensive and I don't play around with that at all. I just get enough to sip while I'm doing this. I'm pretty sensitive. I can't have a lot of whiskey. I usually dilute it. I know I dilute it, but I can't just do it straight up. I don't. Well, I'm in the backyard of my common sense epistemology professor, Dr. Doug Guyvet, my mentor for a long time. Yes, I do know I need to cut my fingernails, and I'm going to do that. Don't worry. We've been house sitting for him for over since 2003 when I was his TA. And, Dr. Guyvet came on the podcast with his co-author, Holly Pivick. And they've done wonderful work on the so-called New Apostolic Reformation. I think they've written like five or six books, maybe at least four. I know that Reckless Christianity, Counterfeit Kingdom, The New Apostolic Reformation, God's Super Apostles. Check those books out. Make sure you have them on your bookshelf. Work your way through them. They're going to benefit you. Check out that episode we did. We had a spirited conversation where I attempted to defend a little bit some of these guys politically because some of them are my friends and it's a political thing. I mean, theologically, of course, I'm on Doug's side and on Holly's side. But in terms of politics, I like to, it's a politics of addition, not subtraction. And why? Because of this stuff. Because this dominates a major part of the globe and we need friends. We don't, it just makes sense, Oh, anyway, so check out that stuff and also check out Doug's other books like Evil and the Evidence for God, Temple University Press. It's Common Sense Epistemology, Religious Epistemology. He also did Contemporary Perspectives in Religious Epistemology, Oxford University Press with Brendan Sweetman. That's got a great essay by Dallas Willard. Great stuff in there. In Defense of Miracles is another one. He's done tons of great stuff. The Testimony of the Holy Spirit with Paul Moser. Paul Moser is kind of crazy politically, but don't hold that against him as far as epistemology goes, because he's got really interesting insights and he's a Christian philosopher, and I respect that. So, Paul, I think you're a little bit crazy on politics, but Paul, thank you for all the work you've done in religious epistemology. Really appreciate it. And so, Doug studied under Dr. Dallas Willard at USC for his PhD, and we're so blessed to be here and to be able to hang out in this by this pool to do these reflections on Marxism and help to have someone like Thomas Sowell just clarify some of these issues for us is so great. J.A. Schumpeter, sometimes it's called Schumpeter, once observed, continues Sowell on page 13, "This is all the more important because the necessity for it does not show on the surface." That's interesting. That is, words like alienation or contradiction from Hegel. Oh, this is so good. This explains so much because I remember seeing the word contradiction and I was like, what are you talking about? Contradiction. I was trained in analytic philosophy. Contradiction is assertion of A and not A at the same time and in the same respect. It's necessarily false when there's a conjunction of A and not A. It's necessarily false. How is Hegel using the word contradiction? It's a very different use of the term. We went through his philosophy of history. So that is words like alienation or contradiction from Hegel or wages and value from Ricardo. And see, I didn't know that because I haven't read Ricardo. Can be taken in their ordinary senses and Marx interpreted coherently, but incorrectly and completely missing the point of his arguments. Marx's business cycle theory, for example, has been grossly misunderstood by interpreters who have seized upon the word contradiction in its ordinary non-Hegelian sense. I want you to get the sense of this. Well, I guess you can already hear this bird. We have some dumb birds here. They just go. It's like, come on, let's have some more interesting songs, like the East Coast people. Can we? Can we just once? All right, I'm gonna get rid of the background noise. Just hear this, okay? In other words, Sowell is saying, if you really want to understand Marx, you have to look at the substance, not just the form. And that means you have to dig into some of these technical usages in Hegel and Ricardo. Okay. So wages and value from Ricardo can be taken in the ordinary senses and Marx interpreted coherently, but incorrectly and completely missing the point of his arguments. Marx's business cycle theory, for example, has been grossly misunderstood by interpreters who have seized upon the word contradiction in its ordinary non-Hegelian sense. Marx's prediction about wage levels under capitalism have likewise been greatly distorted by interpreters unfamiliar with the peculiar Ricardian concepts of rises and falls in wages. Now, you might be thinking at this point, I'm not going to read Ricardo, I'm not going to read Hegel. Okay, fair enough. Okay, fine. You just need to know that this is an issue here and how to interpret the particular vocabulary that he uses. And you might need to understand that the way Marx uses those words is not necessarily the ordinary sense. And so you might get something that is completely missing the point of it, what he's actually saying. Okay, that's all. That's a point that could be made at any level on any topic. Just be careful when you're interpreting somebody. Marxism is not inherently difficult to understand in either its philosophic or economic aspects. It has, however, been made difficult by a number of circumstances. One was Marx's method of presentation, especially in his massive classic, Capital. Other sources of difficulty are the numerous and diverse interpretations by writers who have not troubled themselves to study the philosophic and economic framework of Marx's ideas. Schumpeter listed a formidable set of prerequisites for studying Marx, and these can also be read as a list of reasons why so few interpreters have understood Marxism. Wow, that's interesting. Much of the modern economic literature, for example, sidesteps the whole problem of interpretation by taking what is commonly believed about Marxian economics as a starting point, and then elaborately analyzes and critiques the implications of these Marxian doctrines, often without a single reference to anything actually written by Karl Marx on the bottom of page 13. Page 14 at the top. Are you getting this? Soul is a very careful thinker. And I want to thank the Lord for Thomas Soul. Let's have a little chaplain's corner right now. Lord, thank you for this day. Thank you for the day. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. This is the day. This is the day that the Lord has made, that the Lord has made. We will rejoice. We will rejoice and be glad in it, and be glad in it. For this is the day that the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. This is the day. This is the day that the Lord has made. Thank you for Thomas Sowell. Thank you. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for what he's making clear in this book. And may it help and go forth and bless and create conditions more suitable for human flourishing in decision makers. Another source of interpretive difficulty on the top of page 14 is that the classic writings of Marx and Engels were polemics written against competing doctrines. Many of these competing doctrines were prominent at one time but have now disappeared into obscurity, so that later interpreters have not fully understood what it was that Marx and Engels were arguing against, and therefore have not always understood the real thrust and limits of their words. In addition to its own problems of interpretation, Marxism shares a common danger in the history of ideas: the tendency to interpret earlier writers by reading back into them later ideas and events. Thus, Keynes's ideas have been read back into Malthus and fascism into Pareto. To avoid this fatal trap, Marx's communism with a small c will be distinguished from 20th century communism with a capital C as the doctrine of a peculiar set of parties or governments. The degree of correspondence between the two is an empirical question to be investigated at the end of the analysis, not a foregone conclusion to be assumed at the outset. In other words, he's saying, guys, avoid groupthink. Okay, you might get some things right with groupthink, but you're probably going to get something important wrong with groupthink. Okay. So you just got to be aware of the phenomenon of groupthink because it's a real thing. Okay. That's all. That's all he's saying. And isn't that common sense? Don't you think? Finally, there are claims made by some scholars that Engels did not really understand Marx's idea, and that much is taken as authentic Marxism in Engels' writings, that's incorrect or misleading. This would be unfortunate if true, for Engels' writings are often much clearer than Marx's. That's true. And a valuable source of clarification would be lost. Nevertheless, this claim will be examined in later specific discussions. For now, it may suffice to point out that Engels and Marx collaborated for 4 decades, exchanged letters with great regularity, and each wrote part or all of some writings that appeared under the other's name, in addition to their explicit co-authorship of many writings. It is no small task to intellectually separate Marx from Engels, nor has this task been seriously undertaken by those who depict Engels, an intelligent and well-read man, as misunderstanding a friend whose ideas he was more familiar with than anyone else in the world. Page 15 at the top. In short, there are difficulties of interpretation due to the original sources, the intellectual background, and a prior interpretive literature that obscures more than it clarifies. These are the author's problems. The reader's problem is whether the Marxian ideas, once disentangled, are excessively complex in themselves. But he says this: they are not. They are not. I'm intrigued. That should become apparent in the chapters that follow. Oh, this is good news. As we examine first the philosophy, then the economics, and finally the historical legacy of Karl Marx. The approach here will be neither an uncritical exposition of Marxism nor a continuous sniping at the Marxian ideas in the process of explaining them. Rather, the exposition and the critique will take place in separate chapters. And that's the end of the first chapter. It was a short chapter. The other chapters are a little bit longer and more complicated, but that's all right. So we got the dialectical approach coming up, philosophical materialism, Marxian theory of history, the capitalist economy, Marxian economic crisis, Marxian value, political systems and revolution, Marx the man, the legacy of Marx. Let's get a little bit into the dialectical approach. Chapter 2, page 16. Out of the massive and complex writings of the philosopher G.W.F. Hegel and the derivative writings of the neo-Hegelians who flourished in Germany during Marx's youth, certain key concepts of Marxism developed. Then and now, these concepts have produced an arcane language of their own, less an expression of than an obfuscation of the underlying ideas. Dialectical materialism is perhaps the most comprehensive of these arcane terms, though not a term used by either Marx or Engels. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? Okay, I'm intrigued. It is a general label for Marxian philosophy, expressing the simple fact that Marxism uses the approach called dialectics by Hegel, and also in the centuries-old philosophic tradition known as materialism. Materialism. These two aspects can be examined separately, and then their interactions seen in the Marxian theory of history in general and of capitalism in particular. This will be done in chapters 2 through 4. And then so he goes, the next section is on dialectics. Dialectics, and that starts on page 17. Okay. Now, where do we want to go from here? I think I will do the dialectics section and we'll stop at methodology, okay? And then we'll pick up there next time. So we will go to. We'll do the dialectics now. Okay. Let's hear a little bit of the waterfall in the background. Did you guys have a good week? All right. Dialectics, page 17 at the top. Marx and Engels emphasized the dialectical method of Hegel, the way he looked at and analyzed the world, rather than the elaborate philosophic system erected in books or the mystifying language in which he expressed it. Go back to noise removal on so that you can just hear this. What Marxian philosophy derived from Hegel was that the way to understand the world was not to see it as a collection of things, but an evolving process. An acorn or a caterpillar could not be understood as a fixed and isolated thing without seeing that it was a transitory stage of an ongoing process that would eventually turn one into an oak tree and the other one into a butterfly. Social analogs to metamorphoses in nature abound in the writings of Marx and Engels. Dialectics in Plato, who was not a materialist, okay? Actually, Hegel was not a materialist either, okay? All right. Dialectics in Plato referred to the counterpoints of an argument. Dialectics in Marx referred to opposing forces in reality, internal and inherent forces whose mutual conflicts produced metamorphoses. I have something to add here, and I'm a little bit hesitant to do it because Tom is a friend and I love him to death. He's old now. He likes photography and he's out of the public eye. And you know, he deserves any downtime he gets. He's done so much great work. But I would say it's a little bit misleading what he said, because when he says dialectics in Plato refer to the counterpoints of an argument, as if that had nothing to do with reality. Dialectics in Plato, well, the opposing forces in reality are exactly what are uncovered in an argument for Plato, meaning the argument itself is reality. The concepts are reality. And, you know, the way they're I'm not saying that I understand exactly how this is supposed to go in Plato as well as he meant to say it, or even whether he made any sense when he said it. Suffice it to say, when you're talking about ideas, you're talking about reality for Plato. Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. I think what he meant to say, what Sol meant, is that dialectics in Marx refer to opposing forces in physical reality, internal and inherent forces whose mutual conflicts produce metamorphoses. It is not the shaping of clay. See, that's a physical reality. It's not the shaping of clay by an external force for an external purpose, but the unfolding of internal forces, however you understand the word internal there, each intrinsic to the thing itself, however you understand that. I'm not saying, and notice he's not saying these can be defended, but that this is just what Marx means. It's a little bit hard to get at this. each intrinsic to the thing itself that transforms it into some other thing, predetermined by what went before. Acorns do not become butterflies, nor caterpillars become oak trees. Each unfolds according to its own inner pattern. And the inner pattern, I'm not saying you can make a materialistic account of that that makes any sense ultimately, but what he's saying is that this is the best way to understand how Marx understood himself. Okay, so we're not criticizing him yet. And I'm not even sure what Sol is going to say as far as the criticism exactly, as far as what I'm saying, but let's continue. By the way, check out Rob Koons's episode, The Fundamentals of Metaphysics. He's a teaches at the University of all my exes live in Texas, Austin. And he's got a wonderful book by with Tim Pickavance called The Fundamentals of Metaphysics. He's also got one called The Atlas of Reality. There's a copy of it down in Doug's study, and I've flipped through it. Excellent book, very expensive though. If you want to send it to me and pay for it, that'd be great. Atlas of Reality. Excellent. Okay, let's keep going. This is metaphysics here we're getting into. Understanding that pattern is understanding the essence of the thing itself. An essence. Oh, really? What's an essence? Oh. Okay. Seeing only a particular phase of it as it exists empirically at a given moment is being deceived by appearances. The distinction between the inner essence and the outward appearance is one which runs throughout Marxian philosophy and Marxian economics. An appearance is not simply a delusion without a foundation. It is quite real, however incomplete, and therefore misleading. The blind men who felt different parts of an elephant were not simply imagining what they felt, but were nevertheless quite mistaken in their inferences about the nature of an elephant. A distorting mirror produces an appearance quite different from reality, but wholly based on the reality and systematically related to the reality. Page 18 at the top. Notice the word reality. Metaphysics studies reality. So this is metaphysics. Okay. Again, check out the episode we did with Mark, Mark, Rob Koons. KOONS at the University of Texas, Austin. He's such a great guy. He was one of my professors in grad school, taught me symbolic logic. What a hoot. What a freaking hoot that was. I'm not saying I understood it heads or tails much at the time, but I sure tried. And I'm glad I took it because guess what? I had to teach it. My first philosophy teaching job was teaching symbolic logic. And I was thinking, oh man, I must be pretty great to get this gig. And then I realized no one else wanted to teach it. That's why they hired me to do it. I'm cutting open a Rerum Novarum All Saints because I had this one left over from last time, and so I just felt like I needed a fresh one. After a while, you just need a fresh one. I mean, you pick up one from the day before. You're not supposed to do that, but what am I? I'm just like, I'm basically a tramp. I'm living on the street here.
I don't think so, given your background.
Yeah, I know. Rerum Novarum. We did a whole series on the Republican professor on Rerum Novarum. Pope Leo XIII, rah, scaring the socialist kids. 1891, Rerum Novarum. Check out that takedown of socialism by the Pope. Slowly but surely, we're moving forward here. It's a little dry. It's not my fave. Rerum Novarum is okay, but it's a little dry. That might be my fault. It's okay. It's blue collar. It's a blue collar B minus. Nothing to be ashamed about. Sure do like that cross. All Saints, Rerum Pax et Bonum. Pax et Bonum. Peace and goodness. Praise the Lord. Okay. Let's continue. Where were we? Oh, where were we? Okay, a given stage of metamorphosis is quite real, but an acorn, a caterpillar, a tadpole, or an apple blossom may be a completely inadequate and misleading representation of what will ultimately develop. Just like a distorting mirror produces an appearance quite different from reality, but wholly based on the reality and systematically related to that reality. The dialectical approach rejects uncritical acceptance of existing empirical appearances and seeks instead the inner pattern from which these appearances derive and evolve. There are both methodological and ethical consequences to this approach. Now, we're going to talk about the methodology next time, and we're going to go to from starting from page 18. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host and my own host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. And I don't have my pencil. Must have fallen out of my pocket. Oh, do I? I have it. Aha! I have it. Ah ha 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 ha! TRP Ep 1. From the beginning, and this was 31 May, 2026 years after Jesus. It's a Sunday, and it's in the Guyvet backyard. It's 7:09 p.m. Okay, so we did from page 11, starting at chapter 1. Through to page 17, page 18. All right. Yeah. Making good use of this money I spent in 1992 or 1993. I can't remember. It might have been 1991. I had this book long before I could understand it, but I tried, and I highly recommend that you get books that stretch you, that are difficult to understand, that make you develop, and that are above your head, frankly. Get that Rob Koons book, Fundamentals of Metaphysics. You'll thank me in the morning. Get Hegel's Philosophy of History. You'll thank me in the evening. Get Doug Guyvet's book, Evil and the Evidence for God. You'll thank me all day long for that one. In Defense of Miracles. Contemporary Perspectives on Religious Epistemology, 1992, Oxford. Take a look at that Willard article, The Three-Stage Argument for the Existence of God. That is fantastic. Willard was Guyvet's mentor in contemporary common sense epistemology, religious epistemology. And get this book, Marxism, Philosophy and Economics by Thomas Sowell. Get it. Get it on your shelf. Get a physical copy and follow along. We'll see you guys next time. God bless. This is the day. This is the day that the Lord has made, that the Lord has made. We will rejoice. Oh, we will rejoice and be glad in it, and be glad in it. For this is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. This is the day. This is the day that the Lord has made. From the Psalms.